Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John, by the way.
And a very good evening to you, Ben, and hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can catch us live, of course, on the internet and as a podcast. Lots to get through as usual. And as usual, we'll start with what to see in the night sky.
Now, coming up soon, Space Station, 9th of July. 5 days' time. Can't wait for that one. It comes around very, very quickly. And it will be in our skies until July the 28th, where it'll disappear again until September the 14th. So put that in your diary. So, Mercury, unfortunately, out of sight. It's right behind the sun and just over to the 11 o'clock mark behind the sun, so we can't see it at the moment. Venus is the one to watch at the moment, and it's minus 4.7 in Leo, just under the sickle, and it's a brilliant evening star, and it's in the west during twilight, and I don't know if you've noticed, Ben, it certainly is getting lower.
Oh,
every
it is, yes.
Single day, and sets around twilight sands. We're just going to miss that soon, and then it'll come back into the morning skies as well, coming up to Christmas, which is not that far away, really, when you think about it. Yeah. So,
Thank you.
In a telescope, of course, Venus is a lovely, dazzling white crescent, and thinning and enlarging. It's now 35 arc seconds from pole to pole, and it's only sunlit 28%, but it still gives a really good, dazzling performance in the sky. Now, Mars, unfortunately, magnitude 1.7, it is also in Leo, and glows weakly 4 degrees to Venus's up or left. Venus's, is that a word or not? Jupiter, minus 2.2 in Aries, arises about 1 or 2 a.m. in the east, northeast, because it's quite bright up to those hours. And we have to keep an eye out for that. Saturn, it's quite dim as well, plus 0.8. It's in Aquarius, it rises by about 11 p.m. Quite hard to see, of course, because it's so dim. And the two elusive ones, magnitude plus 5.8 and 7.9, Uranus and Neptune. And Uranus is just about 11 degrees lower left of Jupiter, so not that far away if you want to have a bash at it with a telescope or a really good pair of binoculars. And the Neptune one is quite hard to find. It's 20 degrees along the elliptic or the ecliptic from Saturn. A little bit of homework required for doing that one, I'm afraid so.
Thank you, John. You mentioned the ISS. Yes, it will be a few days, as you mentioned before. It's back at sociable hours. But if you're up at 2:10 tomorrow morning, or 3:45 tomorrow morning, there are some passes. There are some passes during the early mornings, but they'll get earlier and earlier. And as you say, next week, July the 9th, is it? Back in evening skies?
Yep.
When it will be visible at a more sociable hour. And you mentioned Venus too. It is getting, if you look at it through a telescope, you will see the phase. And on Friday the 7th, that's a couple of days' time, 1, 2, 3 days' time, yes, it will be at its greatest brilliancy, at its brightest. As you mentioned, around about minus 4.7 or minus 4.8, around about that mark there, very bright. You can't miss it, really. If you look to the west, around about sunset, just after sunset, you will see it. But as you mentioned, do it soon. It is sinking lower towards the sun every evening. On the Thursday the 6th, the Earth is at aphelion, which means it is at its furthest from the sun on its annual journey around the sun. The Earth goes around the sun, as you know, and it's not quite a perfect circle that it goes around in. It's a little bit elliptical, and on Thursday the 6th, it will be at its furthest from the sun, and it'll be at 1.0167 AU, and 1 AU is the average distance between the sun and the Earth. So it's just about 1.5% further away than than average, that's all. And also on Thursday, Saturn is 3.5 degrees above the moon. And come next Monday, Mars is only 0.5 degree from Regulus, and the moon is nearby. And last week we were mentioning about the supernova in the Pinwheel Galaxy, and it has, naturally enough, as they do, it's gotten even dimmer. On July 3rd, it was magnitude plus 12, down from its May 25th peak of 11.1. So it's down plus one of a magnitude, but which means it's actually five times? I can't remember now whether one magnitude is... I think it's 2.5 times.
Yes, yeah, so it was difficult to see in the first place.
It was, but
without binoculars or a good telescope, but it's certainly dimming away. Okay. I reckon it would stay in for how many days?
Well,
quite a number, this one, because it was a biggie.
I think it's a factor of 5, if I'm not mistaken. So it's only 1/5 the brilliance or magnitude that it was it was at its maximum. And towards the end of May 25th. Now, I want to briefly run through the moon and the sun. We have a 97% waning gibbous moon. We're just past a full moon, which maybe you have a word or two to say about the book moon and the super moon.
It was called the book.
The book moon,
super moon. Last night was its official super moon, but you will get a good chance to see tonight. Although I think this
it's very cloudy here in Dublin at the moment, and
very pleasant at all whatsoever.
I think for 1 or 2 days either side of it, it's more or less you wouldn't really know the difference. It's to all intents and purposes, it's still full, but technically speaking, it's 97% waning gibbous moon. It's not currently above the horizon at the moment, but it will rise later tonight, about 11:30, when it'll be a 96% phase. And it'll be due south of us just after 3 a.m. tomorrow morning, when it'll reduce just another 1%. And by the time it sets tomorrow, just before midday, it'll be down to a 91% phase. And the sun rises tomorrow in Dublin at 5:04, which, would you believe it, is 5 minutes later than a week ago. And local noon, when it's due south, is at 1:29 p.m., which is 1 minute later than a week ago. And setting at 9:54 p.m., which is 2 minutes earlier than a week ago. And from then we'll have civil twilight until 10:45, and then we'll have nautical twilight until just after midnight, and that will carry on until we'll have astronomical twilight after that, and then we'll have the astronomical twilight until nautical twilight begins at about 2:30 or 2:45 tomorrow morning. So what does that mean? It means 7 minutes less daylight tomorrow than a week ago. Tomorrow there'll be 1 minute 27 seconds less daylight than today, when there'll be 16 hours, 49 minutes and 37 seconds between sunrise and sunset.
Now, speaking just about elliptical orbits, we do sort of travel around the sun. The moon also does that with us as well. And this evening it's at perigee, which it's 360,140 kilometres away from the planet here. That's why we're getting this supermoon. And it looks a little bit bigger, so you get about 30%, a bigger view of the moon as well. So that's what happens. But going along in the month to July the 20th, moon will be at apogee, and it will be 406,289 kilometres away from us here. So this is a slightly elliptical orbit going on. I'm not sure if that's the maximum. I could look it up, but not right now, but I will do it as well. So that, and if you're a meteor shower fan, towards the end of the month, Friday the 28th, we have the Delta Aquarid meteor shower peaking with about 20 meteors per hour. Hopefully after midnight is when that happens, when it's getting dark, or getting darker as the year goes on. So there we are. So that's something to look forward to as well. On an average night, we probably get 1, maybe 2 per hour. And when the meteor showers hit, they get 20 to hundreds, like 120, something like that, in the Geminids and things like that. So they are well worth watching as well. So
thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and me, Ben Emmett, and our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087 179 1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can also catch us live on dublincityfm.ie and as a podcast. Gentlemen, of course, one of the bigger stories of the week is the liftoff of ESA's Euclid mission, which it blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida on the 1st of July. That was Saturday. And it's going to explore the dark universe. This is, looks, again, it's one of these long missions, but the amount of data that it should turn out will be massive. And people keep scientists busy for years chewing over the data.
3D map the universe in 6 years. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there. And the third dimension representing time itself, which is great. So it's going to provide a detailed chart of the shape, the position, and movement of all the galaxies, and will reveal how matter is distributed across immense distances and how the expansion of the universe has evolved over our cosmic history. And this is where we get into dark energy and dark matter, because dark energy is the glue that holds the whole universe together, stops the galaxies spinning apart, as our Earth going around the sun, our whole Milky Way, the arms don't fly out in all different directions. So that's the dark energy holding that together. And in that is the dark matter. And we're getting to know a little bit more. When I say a little bit, I mean a little bit, because we still know nothing really about dark energy, dark matter. And the experiments are going on. So hopefully this telescope, if you want to call that, it'll explore the dark universe.
Yeah, it's going to be a 1.2 meter reflecting telescope, and it's going to observe all galaxies out to about 10 billion light years to create this map of the universe in space and time, and hopefully we'll crack some of those elusive questions about where what is dark energy and dark matter. It's going, in the next 4 weeks, it's going to travel towards the Sun Earth Lagrange point 2. That's where the James Webb Telescope is also, which is a equilibrium point in the Sun Earth system. It's located about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth, or about 4 times the Earth Moon distance, and it's in the direction opposite the Sun. And there, the spacecraft Euclid will be maneuvered into orbit around this point, and then mission controllers will then start its activity and verify all the instruments are working, check the telescope, turn on the scientific instruments, and there'll be an intensive 2-month phase of testing and calibrating Euclid's scientific instruments before they prepare for the real observation. Euclid, as I mentioned earlier, is built and operated by ESA. It's primarily an ESA, or European Space Agency, probe program, of which, of course, Ireland is a part. But it does have contributions from NASA. And as I mentioned, it was, well, it did take off from Cape Canaveral in Florida on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket.
Yeah, there we go. Now, at this stage, I would like to say hello to Richard. He's in the Birmingham area in the UK. Good evening to you. Now, he rang me earlier on. Now, he's got madly into astronomy at the moment. He recently bought himself a I think it was a Newtonian telescope, and he's then he bought a camera, and then he bought a mount, the one that you can take pictures of. But he rang me today, and he's looking at an EQ5 Pro SynScan Skywatcher, one that beams you around the sky, follows all the stars. And there was another one he's looking for, which is the Skywatcher HEQ5 Pro SynScan as well, and they're up around the 1,000 to say 1,400 euro mark, but this seemingly he's done a lot of research on this, and these are the ones to have. Now, he sent me a picture over the weekend, and he started to stack photographs as well, would you believe? And we talked for a moment just earlier on today that while stacking, you must take a few pictures with the lens cap on and then take it off. But I'm only getting to grasp it, but he's picked this up very quick, because he's younger than we are. Yeah. And he's certainly got madly into the astronomy world, and he keeps sending me nice photographs as well.
Oh,
it's amazing how many extra stars you get through the skies that we can't see, with that we can't see.
Yep.
So I'm certainly interested to see what would happen when he gets one of those to put the camera on. He's gone totally mad because here's where he lives. Same when it's the light pollution is quite bad from his backyard, so he needs to get the saturation through the camera into the CCD or whatever they call it, the camera.
Awesome in America. Picker upper. Yeah.
Yep. That's it.
The picker upper. The picture that's picker the scientific upper, term, isn't the picker upper of the light, photons.
So there we go. So we have another couple of models to look at. I have the list in front of me, actually, and probably they start at maybe 200 to 300 euro and they stretch up to 1400 or 1500 euro, depending on what you want to do. So if you are thinking of getting into astrophotography, I suppose the more you spend, the better it is. Likewise, with a telescope, if you have a 4-inch and you can afford a 6-inch, get the 6-inch, etc. But, you know, it's, and get a go-to now, because mine is old technology and I haven't got a go-to, so it takes time to set up a little bit and make sure that it's aimed so it doesn't move. Although it has a motor on it, it follows the speed of the spin of the earth as well, so it's so there's something new.
You're ahead of me. I have to find everything.
I know,
manually,
yeah.
Which is it has its advantages. It's great when you can, you know, when you look at the book. That book we mentioned before, Turn Left at Orion, yeah, which is great for especially for refractors. And if you follow that, and then when you actually find, say, the Numbel Nebula or M13 or whatever, you think, wow, you're getting a real sense of achievement.
And it certainly is well when you see these things.
Now, John, a subject close to your heart.
Yes, I love this.
Junk. John loves junk. Well, that's not junk. Space debris. Well, now, we know there's lots of space debris, but there's a couple of people doing some, running some numbers in computer programs about the potential damage and the potential numbers that we could end up with bits of rubbish orbiting the Earth. And we know, for example, that the amount of space debris has not stopped increasing since the first satellite was launched back in 1957, remember Sputnik 1? But ESA estimates that there are more than, wait for it, 131 million useless space waste objects between 1 millimeter and 10 centimeters in length currently orbiting the Earth at an average speed of 36,000 kilometers per hour, and they come from different sources, such as last stages of rockets, satellites that are no longer operational, and even tools lost in space by astronauts. You see that many, a couple of years ago, that I think it was a female astronaut, and of course they have everything strapped in them and with Velcro, and she let some spanner or hammer go, and off it went into the void. But any piece larger than 1 centimeter is potentially lethal in case of collision. And there are some people at the University of Malaga, and they are coordinating a project on space economy that establishes, from a quantitative point of view, a theoretical model that determines the rate of satellite launches that is optimal to maximize benefits, space, and the amount of space debris. So they're using data from NASA and ESA, and they've developed this computational simulation and about what could happen and when, you know, satellites collide and such like. And there are currently around 6,000 satellites in orbit. And they say, with the number of launches and satellites, it basically negatively affects. Every time something goes up, there's a piece comes off it somewhere, or there's usually a first stage or maybe second stage that could end up in orbit. And some of their calculations show that anti-satellite tests, this is where they're talking about satellites being destroyed, they generate 102,000 more pieces larger than 1 centimeter, and that could take up to 1,000 years to disappear due to the high altitude at which tests are carried out. So it'll take a long time for the orbit to decay and come back to Earth. And they also studied the effects of a hypothetical war in space, and they simulated the destruction of 250 satellites. And using this model, it is estimated that space debris would rise by, guess what, 25.5 million fragments larger than 1 centimeter, thus increasing, of course, the probability of a number of other collisions with other satellites. So we need to be careful, not just destroying Earth, but we won't be able to launch any. It could get to a stage where it would be so dangerous to launch people into space that there'd be just so much junk flying by.
Yes, that they reckon that some of them
could be in danger.
because they're so high in altitude, would take maybe 1,000 years to disappear and come back down and get drawn into the microgravity of Earth as well. So it's a serious problem. And if it hits an astronaut, as they previously have, they've come in from their spacewalks and there's been nicks and bits taken out of their seven
They come
layers.
Back and they're pitted, some of their suits and helmets and their visors.
Right, and that's not recommended for anything to do with space junk. Let's go on to the Parker Solar Probe. Now, you and I watched this, as did Mr. Parker, at the time. In when was that launched?
June 27th.
Yeah, June the 27th. This will be...
not June, it wasn't. It reached a certain milestone last week on June 27th.
Yeah, and it hit 16th orbit around the sun, which is no mean feat. This fella really flies through the skies or the space at 364,610, not kilometers, but miles per hour. And the spacecraft emerged from the solar flyby healthy and operating normally. And this August 21st, coming up shortly, it will swing past Venus. So it really is traveling for its sixth flyby of the planet. And, of course, prepare for a smooth course. The mission team apply a small trajectory correction maneuver on June the 27th, just gone past. This was the first course correction since March of 2022. So this flyby will be the sixth of seven planned flybys on Venus during Parker's primary mission. And it'll arrive quite close to the sun, 4.5 million miles from the sun's surface. Don't think I'd like to be there.
No, it was hot enough here the other day at 93 million miles from the sun.
Yeah, goodness knows what that is. So it's really, it's back, and sun reflector is at the back of all the information gathering equipment that's on it as well. So it was developed as part of NASA's Living with the Star program to explore the aspects of the sun-earth system that directly affects life and society. So all these probes and spacecraft, just some remarkable gathering their own little information. And just sneaking across to the Euclid one that took off. I didn't see it live, of course, but I did see the...
Yeah, but you can go back and look at it.
Yeah, we saw the video. ESA, you often worry, and I actually feel a bit nervous when I see things like that, that they might not get where they're supposed to going. But everything went tickety-boo, and they're off to Lagrange 2, somewhere up near the James Webb Telescope. Not sure exactly, but it's about 1 million... Is it kilometers?
1 million miles, 1.5 million kilometers.
1.5 million kilometers away from us here. And it's going to take 6 years to complete its mission of taking the pictures of the whole galaxies. Mm-hmm. Now, not just the Milky Way, the whole of the galaxies.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. And our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text number and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And we're also live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and as a podcast. Now they're playing with fire on the space station, I see. The cool flames. And apparently, the shape of a flame here is kind of... We know it's kind of pear-shaped.
Yeah.
But when something's on fire in zero gravity, it's more spherical. But this is a new type of flame, apparently, that they've produced on the International Space Station. And it is spherical, and it has a blue glow. And these type of flames, they burn at temperatures much lower than traditional hot flames. And they say this could be the key to improving internal combustion engine efficiency, which, let's face it, wouldn't be a bad thing at all. For as long as we have internal combustion engines, that is, and thereby reducing the emissions of harmful pollutants. Now, currently, internal combustion engines, which burn petrol, their efficiency rate is around about 35%. But they reckon with this cool flame chemistry, if you could introduce it into engines, it could theoretically increase the efficiency to as high as 60%. Now, to gain a better understanding of this, researchers are turning to the International Space Station National Laboratory. Now, as you know, on Earth, cool flames, or you may know, cool flames are difficult to study because gravity-driven buoyancy quickly snuffs them out, and this makes the space station's microgravity environment an ideal platform to study these unique flames because they last longer. And eventually they hope that the research, and they learn enough about this that they can employ this technology to make our internal combustion engines much more efficient, cleaner and more efficient combustion engines on Earth, and that wouldn't be a bad thing, as I say, for as long as we have internal combustion engines.
It's not going to be too much longer, and that's another 50 years, maybe something. A lot of those will disappear into electric, which are super efficient and super powerful as well. Just going back to this James Webb telescope, if you want to Google the photographs at the moment of the gas giant Saturn, saw this on the TV the other day, and it's taken in the infrared zone of the camera, and it's a fantastic looking picture as well. It's and it's showing a few of the moons around Saturn as well, and it's well worth a look. So you can get into Google, look at the first James Webb Space Telescope photo of the gas giant, which they've released out into the interworld.
Thank you, John. See, also the SpaceX Dragon cargo spacecraft splashed down off the coast of Florida last Friday, carrying about, nearly 2,000 kilos, 2 metric tons, I don't know,
yep,
of scientific equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Back from the International Space Station, the Dragon detached from the International Space Station's Harmony module on Thursday and made the usual parachute-assisted splashdown. It was about half past three in the afternoon Irish time, 10:30 Florida time, last Friday. That spacecraft was launched from the Kennedy Space Center on the 5th of June and docked with the ISS on the 6th of June. On its way up, it had about twice that amount of equipment and experimental equipment and other resupplies, food, air, water, I presume, when it had about 3.5 metric tons of experiments and equipment on board, including a pair of International Space Station rollout arrays. I believe they have been assembled and they replaced, I think they were, what they did recently, there was a spacewalk where they replaced some of the solar panels. Some of the experiments the Dragon returned to Earth have been aboard the ISS for 6 years. So among the experiments are the ESA's Grip Dextrous Manipulation in Microgravity Chair, which I don't know what that is, but apparently it studies how astronauts manipulate objects in microgravity, and the Gravitational References for Sensomotor Performances, Reaching and Grasping, or the GRASP experiment, which studies the effects of microgravity on the human nervous system. The Dragon spacecraft also brought back samples of myotones, monoclonal antibodies, and other such results of biological experiments up there. And, of course, those samples and experiments will be brought to NASA Space Station Processing Facility at Kennedy Space Center and evaluated, and we wait to hear what they have found out, which we no doubt will in the coming weeks and months.
Just before we go, Virgin Galactic finally took off for its first paying customers to space last Thursday, and everything went very well as well. And if we remember, they have sold at this stage 800 tickets, 600 between 2005 and 2014, for between $200,000 and $250,000, and then the 200 extra ones since then, at $450,000 each. There's inflation for you. Yep, so everything went well there. So we had movie stars, celebrities, and they went up to an altitude of just under 53 miles above the surface. So that really is touching space.
Almost there. Thank you, John, for your news items. And thanks to Alan. He says the reception in Kildare isn't too good this evening. Just one item of news, which I won't dwell on, but apparently Australia had a $1 billion plan to develop a series of space satellites, and they have abandoned that plan. Mm-hmm. Basically, budget, essentially costs was the reason for that. But that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you, John, for your news items, and thanks to James Sweeney for making the show available as a podcast, and Conor Lennon also. He puts it up on astronomy.ie, and the people here who put it up on SoundCloud. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Hello China. 9 o'clock, it's Bren Lynott with Threads. And 11 o'clock, Nigel Wood with Ear to the Globe and his World Music Mix. And at midnight to 2 a.m., we have After Hours with Dave Barry and his mix of jazz, blues and soul. Please join myself and John at the same time next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.